You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Again, the very latest on the shooting at Saugus High School. We'll have developments and an update from the news conference coming up very shortly. Well, as part of the Purple Project for Democracy, you're hearing from familiar voices reading the amendments to the Constitution. Focuses on democratic values and institutions. Here's Roxane Gay, the author on the 19th Amendment.
Hi, I'm Roxane Gay. Your public radio station is celebrating American democracy by presenting the amendments to the U.S. Constitution that lay out our freedoms and how democracy works. Amendment 19. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
That is Roxane Gay, the writer on the 19th Amendment, which we're going to talk about now. It's the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. With us is retired professor of history and gender studies at UCLA, Ellen Carroll Du Bois, author of the forthcoming book, Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. And she reminded me she was a guest on this program so long ago that my hair wasn't gray at the time. Thanks a lot, Ellen.
Me too.
Time marches on. So good to have you, back with us. So take us back to the women's suffrage movement and how many years this took for the passage and ratification of the 19th.
It took 75 years and three generations of women. There were women at the final years who were the granddaughters of some of the initiators of the movement. It was, I think, arguably the longest struggle for a successful amendment in American history.
Going back to the founding of the country, was there much debate at that time about women voting, or was it just such a given, the assumption that, of course, the right to vote is strictly for men?
It was a given. There were one or two women, most famously Abigail Adams, but it was such a given that it was really not until the 14th Amendment, when the suffrage movement for women had gotten started, that anybody felt it was necessary to say that the vote was limited to men. I should add, and the 14th Amendment includes the word male, because by that time women were demanding the vote. And if that word hadn't been in there, there would have been arguments that women were being enfranchised by the 14th and then the 15th Amendment. There's one little detail. Women seem to have voted in Delaware in the very early 19th century briefly, but that's the only, and I think probably because they were voting their property. But
so these would have been women who were unmarried or widowed, or is that why that they would have been able to vote based on title to property?
I'm not sure for sure, but I would say probably unmarried, widowed, and property owners.
All right.
Because women actually married women couldn't own property. And so inasmuch as in the early period of the Republic, when voting was tied to property ownership, marriage disabled women from all property rights.
When the women's suffrage movement really starts getting noticeable attention in newspapers, what are the concerns that are expressed about, you know, what terrible things were said would happen if women were voting?
Well, I think that the really hostile attention really only grew as the movement got stronger. The first real opportunity for women to gain the right to vote, which would have made it, I want to say this to your series, it was in the 1870s, it would have made it the 16th Amendment. And it really didn't get named the 19th Amendment until it was on the verge of being won. At the time, the argument, which came from the party that was the more progressive party, which was, shockingly, listeners, the Republican Party, was that votes for women would interfere with the very difficult campaign to get votes for recently enfranchised African American men. And that was the argument. Or as leaders of the Black suffrage movement said, this was the Negro's hour and women would have to wait. Then, at that point, reaction to emancipation and Black enfranchisement was so dramatic that it threw the country into 30 or 40 years of terrible reaction. And from that point on until the early 20th century, getting a federal amendment was impossible.
What did women do who were advocating for the right to vote, if in that kind of a climate where there's no traction at all? How did they get their case out there?
That's a great question, and really part of the story that I'm most interested in telling. Let me back up for just a tiny minute. The Constitution, the original Constitution, has actually very little to say about voting, and as a result, the general understanding, and it remains the case today, is that control over the over the vote reverts to the states. You know, we are still continue to suffer from that fact. But what that meant, so only the 15th Amendment, which said that the states couldn't disfranchise by race, color, or previous condition of servitude, everything else was left to the states. As a result, the positive side of that was that suffragists could turn to the states and press to have women enfranchised at the state level. And I need to emphasize that when that happened, which it began to happen gradually in the late 19th century, when women got the right to vote because their states changed their constitution, it wasn't just state offices, it wasn't just Congress, they could vote for president.
Really? If they're in a state that allowed women to vote, so, and this is before the 19th Amendment.
This is before the 19th Amendment. And let me just say that California in 1911 became the sixth state to give women full voting rights, which meant that starting in 1912, the women of California could vote for president, which they did, therefore, in two elections before the 19th Amendment.
So what the 19th did was just establish that women residents of all states had the right to vote.
Actually, again, patterned after the 15th Amendment, it doesn't directly tackle state control. It only limits it. It says states can't disfranchise by, and the word they used then was sex.
We're talking with retired UCLA professor of history and gender studies, Ellen Carol Du Bois. She's author of a soon-to-be-published book, Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote, as part of the Purple Project for Democracy series taking place with news organizations nationwide. Here on Air Talk, we're focusing on different portions of the Constitution, talking about the history behind them and the issues that were raised. If you have a question for Professor Du Bois you'd like to ask her about the history of the women's suffrage movement, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, KPECC.org. For women political advocates, did suffrage sort of take all the oxygen? Was that such a cause that the energy all went there? Or were there other issues that were playing out, like women in the workplace or domestic abuse, things like that, that are concurrently happening?
Yes, that's an excellent question. I think one of the misunderstandings of the suffrage movement is that its advocates saw it as a single issue and, as you sort of propose it, paid no attention to anything else. On the contrary, a whole range of other issues brought women into the suffrage movement. You mention, interestingly, domestic abuse. That was in some ways the first major issue that brought masses of women into the suffrage movement. They came in through the historically much maligned Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was concerned with how male drinking led to domestic abuse. Yes.
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt. We take you live to the news conference. Central Park in Santa Clarita.
In Santa Clarita, specifically Saugus High School.